God's name do you need to solve it for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham.
It's that time on a Sunday morning. We enjoy catching up with Mark Latham each and every Sunday. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Brent. How are you going?
Let
me just say about black caviar, it's ridiculous to say that she was overfed to be overbred. She died of laminitis, which is a degeneration of the hooves that horses get randomly. Secretariat, the great American galloper, died of it. He wasn't a mare, he was a stallion. And for black caviar, she died basically at age 18, 9 foals. That's not overbreeding the horse. I mean, people have got to understand, a broodmare is valuable and as great as black caviar, they're treated like royalty.
Yeah.
You know, no one in their right mind, even if you weren't into horses, and we all loved her, if you weren't into horses just for what her commercial value, you'd never mistreat her.
What was she
and
worth?
She wasn't. She died of a hoof degeneration disease where basically they can't stand up anymore and have to be humanely put down.
Sad, sad, sad. What was black caviar worth, Mark?
Well, she won 25 races from 25, and as a broodmare, I imagine all her foals sell for $1 million plus.
Right.
She gave birth to a schnitzel colt most recently, and then had to be put down because of the problem with the hooves. So it's hard to calculate, but multi-million, that's all you can say, Brent, multi-million, and who mistreats a multi-million dollar anything? Car, animal, you know, these animal welfare people need to understand. Recently, we sold a horse, the progeny of Winx, the great Winx, for $10 million.
Mm.
So the idea that they could ever be mistreated, they're put in cotton wool, they're given the best veterinary care, and it needs to be understood that racehorses can live to well into their 20s. The average age for a wild horse, like a Brumby, is about 8 or 9. So without the nutrition, the feed, the vet care, the love, the stabling that racehorses get when they retire, the wild horses have got a lifespan, a mere fraction of that. So if you want to go look after animals, go down to the Snowy Mountains, where unfortunately the New South Wales government is still shooting Brumbies from helicopters. So that's the real outrage we should be addressing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not the fate of the great black caviar.
Butt Veil Black Caviar. My goodness, what a wonderful, wonderful horse black caviar was.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd rate her the second best I've ever seen behind Kingston Town. I think she was superior to Winx and McIvy Diva. She was one hell of a mare. She was unbeatable, 25 from 25, and no one got close to her on her day. And she inspired racegoers right around the world, really, to love the breed and love their achievements. Yeah, she was one in a million.
Would you agree or disagree with this? It got to the stage where, with black caviar, it wasn't who's going to win this race, it's who's going to come second.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was a very good horse from Western Australia called Haylist. If there'd been no black caviar, he would have won 6 or 7 more Group 1 races. And he was always running second. He must have hated the sight of her enormous backside if she strode away down the straight of Flemington or Randwick. Yeah, so it was a battle, a race for second, and she beat a lot of very good horses in her day.
Let's talk about some of the things that's in the news this week. Opposition leader Peter Dutton, he's doubled down on his call to bar all refugees fleeing the war in Gaza from entering Australia. He was on the telly, I think it was Friday, and he confirmed he'd made the initial announcement after speaking with his national security team all about it, and he spoke with them and he made that announcement. It was a step up from the coalition's previous call for tougher security on Palestinian refugees, and not one that apparently was discussed with the shadow cabinet, Mark.
Well, good on Peter Dutton, because he's experienced in this area of immigration and home affairs, and he's putting the security and safety of Australians first. Surveys in Gaza have shown that 70% of the residents there support the Hamas terrorist attack on the 7th of October that killed over 1,000 innocent Israelis. So you take a pretty big risk for people who support terrorism to come into our country and potentially commit the same horrendous acts here. Now, under the ill-fated, hopeless immigration minister Andrew Giles, he issued 3,000 tourism visas to Gazans. misuse of the visa. They're not here as tourists. And 1,300 have come to Australia, and 500 of those are seeking protection visas, which is basically permanent refugee status in Australia. And none of the 1,300 who've been here, that have come here, were interviewed face-to-face. And these tourism visas were issued within 24 hours. So, Brent, shouldn't the alarm bells be ringing loud right across Australia that the Albanese government, in letting these people in, is not going through the proper processes? There should be face-to-face interviews if you're going to do this. It shouldn't be a tourism visa. There should be ASIO security checks. And you really, really need to be careful when 70% of the cohort you're talking about have supported a major terrorist attack in the Middle East. So Peter Dutton is right on the money here. Australian security must come first. The Albanese government seems to think open borders come first, and that's endangered Australians, I think.
Dutton said the decision to grant visitor visas to people from a war zone without face-to-face interviews was unprecedented. It beggars belief, really, doesn't it?
Well, you'd have to wonder, is this another Labor sop to their Middle Eastern type electorates where they're worried about losing seats like Watson for Tony Burke and Blaxland for Jason Clare, that instead of doing face-to-face interviews and security checks, you can get a tourism visa to come to Australia straight out of Gaza? I think your average Australian, Brent, would be horrified by this, and it shouldn't be happening. Peter Dutton has been called a racist and everything else you expect, but the truth is he's putting our security first and foremost, and I just think whether it's gone to shadow ministry or not, it's the right policy, and I'm horrified by what Andrew Giles was doing with those 3,000 visas, and the fact that 500 are wanting to stay here permanently is a bigger worry.
Let's talk NAPLAND, the NAPLAND results. Given the latest NAPLAND results, it's obvious that our educational standards are, well, they're saying, Mark, that our education standards at the moment are a national disgrace, putting over a million students at risk, despite the additional billions of dollars invested in countless years of innovations and fads. About 30% of our students are still underperforming.
Well, they haven't reached the minimum national standard, and it's another example of the more money government spends, the worse the results. So it's not how much you spend. The school's quality debate is not about funding. I mean, that's been put out there, but I've been to schools in disadvantaged areas where they say, we've got so much Gonski money, we don't know how to spend it all. So the funding is not the issue. It's what's being taught and how it's being taught in the classroom. And we need a lot more class time on literacy and numeracy. We need a lot more basic checking. In New South Wales, we have a check for literacy, a word check in year one. Can they do basic phonics? And we need that for numeracy as well. And we need teachers who teach according to the evidence. One of the fads out there, and it's a disaster, and it's the reason NAPLAND results have gone down the sink, is that teachers have embraced what they call student-led learning. The students teach themselves off the internet in small groups doing projects while the teachers walk around the class as facilitators. A lot of these teachers no longer think they're teachers, they're facilitators.
Yes, they are.
With a cup of coffee going from group to group. Teachers need to teach, and by far and away the best form of instruction, get the best result for these students, is direct instruction. The teacher stands at the front of the classroom and gives them the information they need with a rich interchange of ideas with the students. I've seen that in practice. It works. The best schools all over the world do direct instruction. The schools that are losing out and the students missing out do this student-led facilitator style, and that's been the disaster that's got to be reversed.
Well, I suppose teachers are also told to prioritise student choice, and this has been going on now for a long time. In the article I was referring to, it says for the last 50 years, this is what teachers have been told.
Student choice. Well, I tell you what, if you come out of school illiterate and innumerate, you ain't got many choices in life. Your main choice will be down to Centrelink office. And that's the problem. Any policy that thinks we're being kind to the students by going soft on their literacy and numeracy skills is cruel to those students, because there's not much of a pathway in life if you can't read and you can't do basic numbers and you haven't got basic logic and reasoning skills. So we used to have a very good education system, one of the best in the world. The teachers moved to this failed education teaching method. We've got to turn it around. Now, in New South Wales, they've said, oh, they're going back to direct instruction. But, Brent, at the same time, the New South Wales government under Minister Prue Carr and Premier Chris Minns have reduced the amount of classroom observation. You won't really know if they're going back to direct instruction if they haven't got inspectors and principals and deputy principals who go into the classroom and observe what the teachers are actually doing. The Teachers Federation have convinced Carr and Minns to get away from classroom observation, just let the teachers do whatever they like, and that's going to be a major problem because a lot of the teachers will just ignore the directive about instruction methods and do their own thing, which has failed in the past.
Yeah, very true, very true. Let's talk about the gambling ads. It's advocates and health experts have warned that Labor's proposed gambling ad restrictions, they say, are manifestly inadequate after print ads are going to be exempted and restrictions on broadcast ads, well, they're not going to apply until 2026.
I don't know. Yeah, well, you've got to treat people as adults, Brent, but this is an attitude, a nanny state attitude, to treat people as children, that somehow we're all hypnotised by ads. You know, I was driving to Rose Hill Racecourse yesterday. I'm a responsible punter. It was a great day out. I loved every minute of it. And an ad came on to say, imagine what you could have been doing with the money. Imagine what you could have bought with the money that you gambled. Well, if I wanted to go buy things, I'd be at the shopping centre, wouldn't I? But going to the racetrack, you're not going to influence me with those ads. So a lot of this is just treating people as children. And the restrictions in place already are a denial of what I think are basic rights of a citizen in Australia. The big thing they've done is say you can't use your credit card to top up your online gaming account. Now, how many places can you go? After COVID, everyone uses the tap-on card. But the one restriction we've got is you can't do it for your online gambling account, say with Sportsbet. So you can't even choose how to access your own money. It's your own money, not the government's money. It's your own money. And they say you can't use a credit card. You've got to use PayPal, which has a commission amount of up to 3%. So I don't know what influence PayPal had over the federal government, but they're rolling in money now because they're the avenue of choice for these online gambling accounts. So a lot of this is just plain wrong. Treat people as adults. If someone's got a gambling problem and it's identified, we'll obviously give them the counselling and other support they need. But most people, especially at the racetrack, are very responsible punters. We're there for a day out. The main problem with problem gambling is in the clubs, of course, and those ads don't have any impact on poker machines at all.
Well, look, I just can't understand how betting organisations pay for these ads and pay a princely sum for these advertising, particularly on television. And at the end of the ad, every one of these ads has basically, they've just done a, let's say, a 20-second ad or a 45-second ad to promote betting. And the end of the ad, it says, imagine what you could have done. Basically, it says, imagine what you could have spent that money on if you hadn't spent it on betting. To me, it's the same as you've got a KFC ad, and at the end of the KFC ad, after you've just spent 30 seconds promoting the wonders of Kentucky Fried Chicken, they come on at the end of the ad and they say, but imagine how good you'd be feeling if you just had a salad instead.
Well, it's the theatre of the absurd. You're right. The gambling ad comes on and then they basically tell you you're an idiot. And the equivalent is the KFC ad where that would come on and then they should say, you know, you'll end up a fat boy.
Yes.
Or fat girl. So what's the point in doing the advertising? And it all just sounds so ridiculous. And when you hear it, you know, I'm a 63-year-old man. I know what problem gambling is. I've seen it in the past in family history. And I would never, ever go down that pathway. And I listen to these ads and think, well, they're just treating me like some sort of childish moron by putting on an ad and then directly contradicting it straight away. We don't do it in other areas. You know, what about the problem of childhood obesity? Massive in society. You don't hear McDonald's and KFC with the tag that you'll end up a fatso. So why do we do it for gambling? I mean, it's just the selective nature of the nanny state and these social engineers who can't treat people as adults.
Crossbench MPs in New South Wales are demanding that poker machines be turned off in clubs, pubs and the Star Casino on Anzac Day. Now, this has come about after the Minns government has introduced legislation to ban all retail on Anzac Day.
Well, we had this debate in the upper house on Thursday night, Brent, and thankfully the Greens amendment to ban the poker machines on Anzac Day was defeated. I made the point, well, the Greens don't like Anzac Day. They describe it as a celebration of militarism. So they denigrate the day. At the end of the day, they always say that there'll be a domestic violence spike at the end of Anzac Day. I don't see them at the dawn service, any of the Green MPs, but there they were again, as social engineers, trying to stop a digger who's marched, who's had a few beers with his mates, putting a few dollars through the poker machine, if that's their way of enjoying the day, and it's their special day. Should the Greens, who don't like Anzac Day, be telling diggers how to do Anzac Day? It just seems so hypocritical, and the amendment was defeated. So I don't think there's any great damage with a digger if that's their choice. I don't see many Green MPs who put their lives on the line for their country and fought in wars, but these fellows have, and the women have, and if they want to put a few dollars through the pokies, well, I say good on them, and we honour you on Anzac Day no matter what you do. You can have a few beers and relax and enjoy the company of your comrades.
But isn't it the same with the retail side of things? I mean, in the past, retail shops haven't opened until after midday. I mean, if you respectfully get up, you want to go and pay your respect on Anzac Day, you get up, maybe you go to the dawn service, maybe you don't go to the dawn service, maybe you just get up early and you watch the dawn service on TV, you might go to the march, you're paying your respect. Why can't you go and buy a litre of milk after midday?
Well, there'd been a campaign by the shoppers' union to say they want their workers to be available on Anzac Day for the dawn service. Some places have a midday service or a mid-morning service, and there's a lot of retail workers who want to go and do that. The main focus on Anzac Day, of course, are the services and then pubs and clubs. The clubs, RSL clubs, of course, put on a breakfast or a lunch for the diggers, and then they have the beers and maybe some activity on the poker machines. The pubs have the traditional two-up. So if they're the main focus, then retail, I think, has kind of been dispensed with on Anzac Day to allow the retail staff to participate as well. That's been the argument that the Minns government has put forward. I want to see how it works, but it sounds a bit reasonable to me, I've got to say.
Sydney signers could be allowed to drink alcohol in public places such as parks and beaches or on the street in entertainment precincts, as Chris Minns. He is open to changing laws that prohibit the drinking of alcohol in open spaces.
Well, I think that's long overdue. We had so many restrictions on everything during the COVID period. And if people can drink responsibly, local government have had the powers for these alcohol-free zones, but they're just signs on the street. You never really see them being observed. And if there's a cafe that wants to serve a glass of wine to someone who sits on the footpath, is that the end of civilization? Not really. Again, it's a matter of treating people as adults. If you break the law and do anything stupid, obviously the police should arrest you and you're in big trouble. But I think responsible drinking in public places is not a great problem. It happens anyway. I think people just ignore the signs. You can always have a drink on the beach, just put it in a different type of container. So none of these things have been followed in the past. Although Chris Minns, he's a funny old character, I've got to say, because there's now a proposition circulating in the New South Wales parliamentary precinct to ban alcohol. So we're the lawmakers, we're the people elected notionally to run New South Wales, and Minns thinks we're not adult or responsible enough to have any alcohol in New South Wales Parliament House. But on the other side of Hospital Road in the Domain, apparently he wants a rule to say you can have a drink there. So it all seems a bit cockeyed to me. Maybe he's got some alcoholics in the Labor caucus. Sometimes that's a bit obvious around the place, but I don't think it's a rule that should apply to everyone. If he's going to have drinking on parks and beaches, surely in New South Wales Parliament House, you should be able to have a quiet drink with a guest or in the bar or in the restaurant. It just seems ridiculous.
It does, but I suppose people listening to us would say, yes, agree, but there have often been stories that people are going into Parliament to make decisions and they have had too much to drink, and that shouldn't happen.
Well, they should be outed and they shouldn't be in Parliament, and they have been outed in the past. There's been a few ministers who've lost their job because they were full as a boot late at night. But if you're working from 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. at night and you want to have a quiet beer at the end of your work day, I don't think that should be denied anyone.
No, I don't know
out there. But if you drink, I've seen MPs you saw them in the restaurant at lunchtime and after dinner, they could barely string two words together. Well, they tend to be kicked out of the system, quite rightly so, because they've made a spectacle of themselves. But anyone in any workplace who works a very, very long day and they want to relax and unwind and get a better night's sleep by having a quiet drink, I think that's fine, particularly if you've been elected by the people, then should be treated as an adult in the New South Wales Parliament.
Let's talk breakdancing. The Australian breakdancing athlete, Rachel Gunn, she became one of the biggest stories of the Paris Olympics. She says the hate she's received after bombing out of the competition has been, she said, pretty devastating for her and her family. Gee, she's copped some flack.
Well, I don't think it's been hatred. It's more laughter. Suppose a bit of ridicule, because her performance was ridiculous. She went to the Olympics and the judges gave her zero marks, and by definition she ran last with a routine that you'd think, oh, I could see better breakdancing down the local skate park or in some pub late at night than all of that. And there has been other videos put up of the people that she beat for the Australian nomination to go to the Olympics, and they looked a lot better than what she actually did on the day. So I think Ray Gunn and others need to realise people will judge this with their own eyes. It was ridiculous. It was kind of funny. You had to wonder what she was really trying to achieve. Some people say it was a left-wing protest display. Protesting what? I don't know. So it was quite absurd, and the public's got the right to have a laugh, particularly when, as taxpayers, we've helped fund all these Australian athletes in Paris at the Olympics. And for the athletes who receive all the praise and they're our heroes, we put them on a pedestal quite rightly, well, that's great. But on the flip side, if you bugger up to the point of comedy, well, people will say that, won't they? So I don't know anyone who hates her. She needs to recognise she stuffed up badly and probably needs to apologise for a performance that internationally was seen as an embarrassment.
Well, it's been written and said this week, if that's the best we had to offer for the breakdancing competition, why in hell did we enter anybody?
Yeah, exactly. And surely that money could have been used to fund other athletes who had a better chance of, you know, displaying an Olympic quality performance. I'm not too sure breakdancing is an Olympic sport, nor skateboarding. You know, these things seem to have got in by chance into the Olympics. They're not really sports. I think the Olympics should stick to the things that, you know, we've always recognised over the years that are actual sporting activities. But we're going to have breakdancing, why not ballroom dancing? You know, jazz dancing, jiving, whatever. Why is it breakdancing? So that in itself was ridiculous. It won't be there in LA in 4 years' time, and the Ray Gunn controversy will end. But I think she needs to recognise nobody hates you. We just had a good old laugh about it, and quite rightly so.
New South Wales Liberals have been slammed for this election blunder. I see the Liberal Party's considering filing a court case against the Electoral Commission. They say it could even happen today after the Acting Commissioner refused its last-ditch request for a one-week extension to nominate candidates in next month's council elections. Talk about muck-ups. What a muck-up this was, Mark.
Well, and a further waste of money. If they run a court case, it's not the Electoral Commission's fault that they failed to get their nominations in on time. They're not going to have candidates on the Northern Beaches, Lane Cove, Campbelltown, Camden, down the South Coast. This is an error of the Liberal Party's own making. I mean, Brent, the most basic thing in politics is you can't be elected if you don't nominate. And every single candidate and party sweats on this, gets prepared for it. They knew the nomination date 3 or 4 months ago. How hard is it to fill out the forms needed to put your candidates on the ballot paper? So the Liberal Party has sacked its own state director. They've admitted there was a stuff-up. There's calls to get rid of Don Harwin, their state president. They know they've buggered this up. So no point blaming the Electoral Commission, no point going to court about it. You're just going to have to suck up the fact it's a gross act of political incompetence on a scale that we've never seen before. So every other party, and I haven't heard of any other independent or Labor or Green person, minor party candidate who failed to nominate. It's the Liberal Party alone. So they're just going to have to suck up their own incompetence, aren't they?
Yes, it's been written and said again this week. You had one job.
One job, that's it. One job is the slogan, and they messed that job up entirely.
They sure did. Always great to catch up with you, Mark. We enjoy our chats each and every week. Thank you for making yourself available. You've recovered from last week's city to serve.
Yeah, much better shape. The legs were pretty good on Monday. I thought I wouldn't be able to walk after 14 Ks, but I was pretty good. I shocked myself. But, I've got a year to recover.
All right, mate. Fantastic. We'll talk to you next week.
Always look forward to it. Thanks, Brent.
Thank you, Mark.